Welcome to 1066 and all that important dates in British history. You know this panel, but I'm very briefly going to introduce them to you. So we've got Helen Carr, award-nominated writer and historian specialising in medieval history, author of The Red Prince and Sceptred Isle. We've got Al Murray, of course, who's a comic with a passion for military history and the Second World War, and of course does the brilliant podcast We Have Ways of Making You Talk with James Holland. We've got the fantastic Alice Loxton here, a history broadcaster with a huge social media following, and her latest book, 18, was Blackwell's Book of the Year 2024. And last but not least, we've got Charlie Higson, author, actor, comedian, and writer. So I will hand over to these very capable four, just so that you know as well, there will be time for questions. So if you've got any questions, please wait until the end. I'm sure they will get answered. And also, all of our panel will be doing signings at the end of the event as well. So thank you very much. Please give them a warm welcome.
Contestants on a game show.
thank you very much. If you do ask questions, don't ask any difficult ones, please, as I'm not really a historian. Although I did work out the other day that I've been doing events at Chalk Valley, Chalk History as it now is, since 2013, which was, I think, the third ever festival. I mainly come to do the Histrionics quiz. Who's hoping to go and see that tonight? Ooh. Excellent. Highlight of the festival, I'm sure you'll agree. And so I was asked to do that, and then James Holland said, well, while you're there, why don't you do a talk about something? You write about James Bond, do a talk about that. And I've been doing fairly spurious history talks ever since. To the extent that I eventually started a podcast called Willy Willy Harry Steve, which is a history of the monarchy. And I'm finally working on a book of that, which will be out at Christmas. And I'm hoping then that I can call myself a historian, because I will have written a history book. Helen and Alice have both been guests on the podcast. Al keeps turning me down. He claims he's too busy. But it's great to be able to have this panel event together and to chat. Yes, it's 1066 and all what? It's kind of famously the one date in British history that everybody knows is 1066, and it is an important day. It's not just the Battle of Hastings. It was when the Normans essentially crushed the Saxons and took over running the country. But increasingly these days, with the way education, history is taught, that the idea of sort of really important dates isn't necessarily rammed home to people. I don't know whether it should be, but so this event, we want to work out what are the really key events that every school child should be forced to learn. Really, it's just a flimsy excuse for us to talk about some parts of history that we're interested in. Now, we were passing around some bits of paper with, so you could add some dates of your own. I don't know if any of those are still going around, but maybe at the end, if you have a date that you're really passionate about that should be on the curriculum, you can throw it at us. There are so many other dates out there that I think people should know. For instance, Scottish children should perhaps learn 1956, which was when Tunnock's tea cakes were first produced. So I've asked Helen, Al, and Alice to each prepare a couple of their favourite dates. We'll start with you, Helen. You've just published your book on the 14th century. Fantastic book. We will be signing books afterwards. So I'm assuming you would maybe like to offer a date from the 14th century?
Are we starting bleakly then? It wasn't a very happy century.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm sure people found ways to enjoy themselves.
Okay, well, I could start chronologically because I write narratively, so I'm going to start sort of earlier on out of my selection of dates. And we'll start with we talked about Scottish children, what dates they should learn. So I think the Battle of Bannockburn is a pretty important date. Hands up if you've heard of the Battle of Bannockburn. There you go. It's an important date that most of us have heard of.
You can tell we're at a history festival, the amount of hands that went up.
But how important is it to the rest of the 14th century? And I would argue that it's very important because it is actually the greatest military disaster for the English in medieval history. in which most of the nobility of England, huge amount of the nobility of England, were crushed in this battle against the Scots. And the sources differ, often in favour of the Scots, who said, oh, we just had very few men. And the English had thousands, 25,000 men versus about 3,000 men. It wasn't quite that level of discrepancy, but they were an inferior force and they crushed the English very famously at this battle. And one of the most famous deaths was the death of Gilbert de Clare, who owned this vast amount of territory on the Welsh March, which then plunged England and Edward II later into a war with his nobility, which actually then pretty much ended his reign. So you can pin quite a lot on the loss at the Battle of Bannockburn.
Right, so Edward II is in charge of the English side. I mean, was he actually at the battle?
He was. Okay. I know there's lots of ideas that Edward II was this sort of very ridiculous individual who just wanted to walk around Westminster Palace with a mirror. But that's actually not true. He was a very efficient warrior. I mean, we've all seen Braveheart. There's that famous scene, isn't there? he was a very efficient warrior. He was a good fighter. He'd been trained in war from an early age. And he was in the thick of the battle. He had to be dragged away because it was in danger that he was going to be captured himself, at which point it would have been total game over and there would have been a Scottish independence very quickly.
So who was leading the Scottish side?
Robert. We now say Robert Bruce rather than Robert the Bruce, but I think Robert the Bruce is the famous way that we're going to talk about him. So call him Robert the Bruce. He was leading the Scots and he had been training this very efficient body of men. He probably had about 8,000 in the Tor Wood, so they've been training for months, you know, doing drills over and over and over to make sure that they were really aware of how they were gonna fight. And what he utilized was something called the Shiltron, which was a famous battle tactic that had been used before, but only as a defensive mechanism. So this is like an armadillo of spears and shields. And there was about four formations, about 800 men or so in each one. My maths is obviously not very good here, so bear with me. But what he did is he taught his men to be offensive rather than defensive. So he taught them to move forward. And you can probably imagine being English soldiers, you know, lined up at the beginning of the Battle of Bannockburn and watching these huge sort of armadillos of spears coming towards you at great pace. Pretty terrifying stuff. So much so, the horses that all of the English knights were mounted on already, you know, gung-ho with all their flags waving, thinking it was all going to be very easy. The horses wouldn't charge forward, and so they were sort of crushed in towards the back of the river, the Bannock Burner, so it's famously called.
So, I mean, you know, we all use Braveheart, of course, as our primary historical source for this.
Obviously. Blue Woad, who wiped this course. The Scots still dress in Blue Woad, don't they?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, that it promotes that idea that William Wallace was this sort of semi-wild peasant, and they were all wearing kilts and nothing else and covered in blue paint, and that the English were all terribly pompous. But it sounds like it's not like that at all, that the Scots were better organised than the English.
The Scots were far better organised, but the English were so convinced of their victory. Edward II led the army up north, up the Great North Road through Berwick. And with him, he brought this this very bewildered cleric called William Baston. And he was brought along on campaign rather reluctantly because Edward wanted him to write about his victory in this lovely long-form prose. So this poetic chivalric verse about how wonderful Edward was and how he defeated the Scots, just like his father had done. And William Baston was captured by Robert Bruce, and Robert Bruce made him do it for him.
Excellent. Now, I mean, Al, you are famously, I think obsessed is probably a word I can use, about the Second World War.
Yes, I think that's kind of fair.
I mean, do you have an interest in the sort of wider military history and things like that?
Well, I've been to Bannockburn, and it's remarkable that these events took place in the car park of a leisure centre.
It's true.
It's incredible, isn't it? You sort of think, okay, so they've just been in the swimming pool. they've had to decide, do you put your socks on before you've dried your feet? Right. Maybe they had to step in the little Veruca bath and all that. Because obviously there's the memorial and it's sort of in the wrong place, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the things I really love about battles from long ago is no one really knows quite where they happened.
Yeah.
They can kind of have an idea, but no one really knows. So that's how they ended up building a leisure centre on what is now the where the battle was.
It's a housing estate. So that's they've worked out recently that it's a housing estate. And I did some filming on this housing estate about a year ago. And this guy was mowing his lawn. And you can see the Shiltron Drive and Pollack's Way. And he was like, do you guys want a cup of tea? And we were just like, thanks.
Did he have a heavily armoured lawnmower?
It would have been appropriate to the scene, I think.
And it is interesting, though, because it's a really important battle in sort of modern Scottish imagination, isn't it?
Yeah.
I used to do a joke about how some Scottish people like to say Bannockburn, but I say Culloden, because it's not the heats that matter, it's the final. And
yeah, I mean, Bannockburn's very interwoven with Scottish, mythology.
Well, it would be, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, but you go to Stirling Castle and Robert Bruce, because there's a huge statue there. I mean, there's multiple statues around Stirling of Robert Bruce. But, I mean, the whole battle itself was all over Stirling Castle. It was fought on Midsummer's Day, very, very romantic. And the idea was that if Edward hadn't come to liberate the siege of Stirling Castle, then Stirling would fall to the Scots, which then meant that the rest of the north of Scotland was open was captured by Robert Bruce, and the English ceased to have any control, which, when you've got Edward I, Hammer of the Scots, doing his damnedest towards the end of his reign to, you know, winning great battles like Falkirk, he's not going to be very happy when his son loses everything.
No. Alice, you do a lot of, you travel around doing a lot of sort of historical films which you post online. Have you done Bannockburn? Do you do battles?
I do battles, but it's the same problem that, you know, you get to these sites, and I've filmed a lot of documentaries and been a producer for these things, and you get to these sites where... and I've been with people like Dan Snow, and they're really trying to hype it up. Like, wow, this is where it happened. This is where history unfolded. And it's literally just a field. And we can't even work out which bit of the field. You know, it's really hard to make these things seem exciting. But actually, one of the best videos I've ever made was at the Battle of Edge Hill, which still has the structure of the landscape. You know, you get a sense of this. And this was the one of the opening battles of the Civil War, perhaps the first moment that there was a clash. And it kind of happens by chance in this South Warwickshire area. And it's this amazing hill, which you can go and walk around today. And so you can get a sense of Prince Rupert being at the top of the hill and the parliamentarians at the bottom. And he had this amazing cavalry charge that came thundering down. But it all ended in a kind of a draw, really. But I think that's probably a rare occasion where you can get a sense of the battlefield.
It's Rupert of the Rhine, who's famously phenomenally attractive.
Yeah.
Like, and if you look at his portrait, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
But is that one of those portraits where you can tell? You know.
Yeah, what are your standards here, Hella? I mean, I've never thought about
Roundheads and cavaliers here.
Well, yeah, no, not that, no. But you know, sometimes ideas of attractiveness, I mean, not sometimes, ideas of attractiveness have changed wildly. Yes. Can you look at that, a portrait of Prince Rupert now, and go, oh, yeah, all right.
Yeah.
So, Alice, what was the year of the Battle of Edge Hill?
1642, October the 21st. Anyone else? Is that correct? Audience?
All shout yes.
Yes. Something like that.
Well, there's a proper historian for you. Well, actually, let's just check some dates that you may or may not know. Shout it out. Agincourt. The Act of Union. 1707, yes, when we officially became Great Britain. Slavery Abolition Act. Well, no, the final... 1833. Okay.
That is so funny.
Yeah, but I think they were... Oh, not because slavery was still going. it's people sounded pretty crestfallen at the idea. Yeah. we are in Wiltshire.
Okay, what about the Liz Truss premiership? It was quite short. 2022 seems like yesterday. There's my sound thing falling off. Al, what was your first date that you'd like to offer up?
The Great Fire of London.
Oh, a classic.
Ooh. And the thing.
What
when year? Was it? The day. September the Second, thank you, that's right. And well done, because I hadn't mugged that up. This is such a fascinating date in English history, but in our imaginations, I think. And of course, I know all about this because my youngest daughter Daisy had to do a celebration of learning event at school, where they get up and talk. Although a lot of the small children get up and mumble, and you have to lean in and listen, or fall asleep at the back like some of the dads. And they did the Great Fire of London. So I listened to 24 7-year-olds.
It sounds just like children.
I mean, it's not unlike this. I mean, my parents are here to help me speak as well. But basically, so there are key facts, right? It started in Pudding Lane, right? If you're next tier, Thomas Farriner's the name of the baker in the bakery in Pudding Lane. And if you're my daughter, you've been told, do you know that the word Farriner is like farine, which is French for flour, which she shrugged off as useless information, right? He's the king's baker, which has led some people to think that maybe there's something at work here, that, you know, that maybe it was all deliberate, which I think is nonsense. Because after all, King Charles II, and this is my other the other reason I'm interested in this, is I 2 years ago, I played King Charles II in a show called The Crown Jewels, about the theft of the crown jewels from the Tower of London in 1771, when 1671, when Captain Blood got into the Tower of London and bashed the man looking after the jewels over the head, and then crushed the jewels and made off with them. But so I started reading about Charles II, who's a fascinating man. And obviously, the last thing he is going to do, having come back as king, and he's riding a sort of providential way vibe. You know, they're into the vibe of Providence at the time. Even the people who have rejected the Commonwealth like the idea of things are changing, things are turning. And they've had the plague in 1665. The last thing he's going to do is burn the city down, right? If he's trying to, like, ride the Providence
way. It's one way of getting rid of plague, though.
It is. It's a highly effective. Of course, this is the thing, is that it's kind of one of those, it's presented as, well, thank goodness the Great Fire of London happened because it stopped the plague. And I'm not sure anyone thought that at the time, no. Right? Much. You know, that might be called hindsight. Anyway, but the...
But that, I mean, that is a classic conspiracy theory. It's like, well, nothing can happen by accident.
Well,
no, it's got to have been caused by something.
It's got to have been caused by something. But it's a spark from one of the ovens. And so a little boy called Yahya, who's an Afghan boy at Daisy's school, he did his presentation. At the end, he went, so, mum and dads, turn your ovens off. Right? I've got a 7-year-old writing my material currently. Right? But it is a fascinating story, because then what follows, obviously, is so London is about 320,000 people at the time, or is it, because there's been the plague? 10 people are killed in the fire, or are they? Because, you know, this isn't a time of spreadsheets and bookkeeping and censuses in the way we would understand it. So no one really knows what the human tragedy is. But the city's destroyed, the centre of it. 100,000 people are displaced. And then, and obviously Samuel Pepys witnesses it, the new mayor of London, right, who's come in at the end of the previous year, so he's just had to deal with the plague. It's a new mayor of London, and I think he's in the Johnsonian mayor of London style. There are children present, so I won't quote him directly, but he says, try good. Seems to me that a woman might be able to pee this fire out. Right? Right? He says that. Slightly more robust terms, but he says that, right?
He's downplaying it at this point.
He's downplaying it. And the reason he's downplaying it, because their anti-fire measure is to pull down the buildings around where the fire is. And he doesn't want to do that. He's worried about damage to private property.
He's the mayor in Jaws.
He's the mayor in Jaws, exactly. And then the city proceeds to burn down. And what's really interesting is King Charles, you know, minute he gets wind of this, he goes in and he joins the firefighting efforts. And he's at the front of the firefighting efforts. He's in bucket lines and all this sort of stuff. Because the thing about Charles II is we probably know him as this sort of fantastically louche, politically able, you know, taking bribes from the French. Is obviously, just, you have to have a lower of opinion because of that. But, you know, converting to Catholicism on his deathbed, maybe, and all sort of stuff. He was a tremendously brave man. And a physically courageous man. In the Civil War, he had a track record of being known to be really courageous.
He hid in a tree, didn't he?
That's right. And his adventures, well, exactly. He did. There's See, that's the other seven-year-old fact. Is that he hid in a tree, the Royal Oak. But he was a courageous man. And in fact, his brother, James, the Duke of York, who then becomes the wildly unpopular James II, or at least unpopular with the political establishment, is displaced. He's also in on the firefighting efforts, in there, front and centre, doing their bit and getting involved. And then, of course, follows rebuilding the city. And, you know, this is an age of reason. Or the emerging age of reason, you know, the Royal Society. So Christopher Wren comes into the king and lobbies the king for this new rational city that he's going to build. It's going to be symmetrical. It's going to have straight lines in it. It's all going to be ordered. And I don't know if, you know, James Holland, who I work with a lot, always likes to say history doesn't repeat itself, but human patterns of behaviour do, right? Which is a mouthful, right? The fact is, Wren's plan for the city, which the king thinks is tremendous, is then stymied by what we would call NIMBYism. There's a whole load of people who go, oh, no, I don't know about that. That's in the wrong place. I own that bit. We can't do that. And it basically stalls completely. And that's why the city of London is still higgledy-piggledy and not laid out with great symmetrical vistas, because the cussed people of London weren't interested in, you know, order.
But I have to say that I prefer a higgledy-piggledy. Yeah.
Oh, so do I.
I'm not a fan of the grid.
So do I.
Very difficult to walk around.
But exactly. But, you know, the men of reason didn't get what they wanted. And I think, you know, the London we have now, and obviously St. Paul's and the other 70 churches that Wren built, are the masterpieces of the age, but also sit in that hinge point between abandoning, you know, it's the cusp of the Enlightenment, where we're actually... You've still got people like Newton, who's doing alchemy as well as discovering gravity. And it's that the 1666 and the redesign of London, the recreation of London, feels like one of those moments that's, you know, looking forwards and backwards at the same time, but brought about by calamity.
And classic English compromise, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Trying to keep everybody happy.
Yeah, exactly.
Not really pleasing all of them. So, I mean, Alice, your date, one of your dates, also concerns a destruction part of London.
Yes, well, I think that's a very convincing argument, Al. And thanks. I think the setting, you know, London is this stage for, you know, so many kind of massive events in the 17th century to unfold. So the kind of physical setting for that is very important. And I go around the country and I film a lot of these locations. And when you go and do this, one of the things that you do really realise, and really kind of hands home to you, is the destruction of so many of our buildings at these particular points of history. Obviously, the Great Fire was a particular moment, but there are two big moments, which is during the Reformation and during the English Civil War, where deliberately so many structures, castles, monuments were torn down, were slighted. And I think it's incredible that Henry VIII has got away with that. You know, we know him as the guy with the six wives and the relationship with the Pope and that kind of thing. But actually, what he should be remembered for is being one of the greatest people who, you know, destroyed our great cultural monuments, our you know, all of the medieval beautiful pieces of artwork, the wall paintings, cathedral, some of the abbeys, the monasteries, all of these kind of things. A kind of destruction of such a core of what it was, you know, the spaces that ordinary people were living in. But the date that I've chosen, because I've been working on this project recently, all about the Eleanor Crosses, if anyone knows what the Eleanor Crosses are, maybe there'll be a book coming about that soon.
Hands up if you know what the Eleanor Crosses
are. Has anyone heard of them?
Yeah. Yes.
That's, okay, so for those who don't know, 1290, Eleanor of Castile, the wife of the bad king, Edward I, the scary king from Braveheart. She suddenly dies near Lincoln. And afterwards, they have to carry her body from Lincoln to London. And this is this 200-mile journey. And in the 1290s, Edward, who is so distraught at losing his beloved wife, it's this great love story. He builds these 12 monuments along the way. They are known as the Eleanor Crosses. And the final one was Charing Cross. But
so that's where they stopped every night on the journey.
So they stopped in December 1290. And when you look, and this is an amazing cross-section of kind of heritage and how it's been treated over the centuries, because most of these do not survive because they were destroyed in the English Civil War. And so the date that I chose, including Charing Cross, so in for what, 300, 400 years, in the centre of London, just in front of the National Gallery, there was the Eleanor Cross. It's now the equestrian statue of Charles I that stands there. And if you go, there's a little plaque and it talks about the Eleanor Cross. It is by chance the central point for measurements to be taken from London. So if you put London into Google Maps right now, it will take you to that exact spot. So when you're in Trafalgar Square next, go and have a look at it. But this was something that was the kind of such a famous monument to defined people approaching London for centuries. And in 1647, Parliament just ordered it to be torn down. They just saw it as this symbol of idolatry. And that is just one example of it. But that was happening across the country. And so I don't think we ever talk about that much when we think about these events, that how important the buildings are around us and how much of a shock it must have been for those people at the time. You think about William Shakespeare, he was growing up in Stratford, but think about the fact that his parents had lived through seeing their churches being whitewashed. You can go to the the chapel in the center of Stratford. I don't know if anyone's been there. It's this beautiful chapel next to King Edward's School. And all the walls were whitewashed. But that was such a dramatic thing to happen to ordinary people. So in a very roundabout way, that's my date, 1647, because of that particular Eleanor Cross. But it's perhaps a wider...
It's a really important
idea
point,
too, do you think?
Yeah, definitely, because people in the Middle Ages, I think the Reformation was an extraordinary change for the layman, because so many people were illiterate. Ways of them engaging with God and understanding what they were being told in churches was by looking at the walls. You know, a lot of these biblical stories were depicted on the walls as these frescoes, and it was this sensory experience for people going into these spaces. It's what made it feel magical and extraordinary and holy. And there's a fact that we see, a medieval person saw as many images in their entire lifetime as we see in one day. I mean, and that was mostly in these religious spaces. And to have that all taken away from you, what that does is just separate any sense of sort of personal how one would relate personally to that religious experience.
I mean, it's like the medieval mind, right? I've been working with some of these English heritage historians. They keep telling me, you've got to think about the medieval mind. Like, this is they have a completely different approach and kind of way of thinking about the world. So when they go to these shrines, for example, at St. Alban's Cathedral, the Shrine of St. Alban, they really believed at these shrines that they weren't just a kind of sacred space, that they had an actual power in the same way that we understand gravity or different forces that keep the world in shape. You know, and that's why people would go there, to feel like they could actually be cured. And so when you think about them just smashing up these shrines, or, you know, just in not that many years, it doesn't take them that long to destroy quite a huge number of these monuments. I think it must have been the most kind of uprooting moment for ordinary people throughout our history.
Thomas, Earl of Lancaster, who was killed, he was a political martyr in the 14th century. His hat was said to cure miracles. So if you went and touched Thomas, Earl of Lancaster's hat, your headaches, your migraines, or your blindness would be cured.
Useful.
That's the sort of stuff you get online these days. Kennedy will probably use it in America. Yeah. Instead of all these chemicals. Cromwell carried on doing what Henry VIII had done as well. And, you know, often dates are the birth of something, when something started, when something was founded. So I think it is good to have a date that commemorates when things were lost. Although I have to confess, I've already forgotten what the date was.
Yeah, it was 1647 that Parliament gave the order to pull down Charing Cross.
Okay.
And they said, there's a funny rhyme. It's like, the Londoners wandering up and down, they know not the way to Westminster, now Charing Cross is down. Like, basically people got lost because they've lost this big man.
I mean, and Charing Cross is named, well, the area was Charing, and then the cross...
It comes from Charing, which means bend in the river. So it's a bend in the River Thames. And then the cross is the Eleanor Cross. There is another story that everyone always says it means share reign, which is beloved queen, something like that, which isn't actually true because it's
already
I'm afraid.
There goes my next 5 minutes.
Sorry, yeah.
But there is
but a convenient by, you know.
There is a replica of... Yes. The Charing Cross.
So the one that you see today is a Victorian replica. The Victorians got really, really into these crosses, Gilbert Scott. And this is the thing, you know, they have this revival later on in the Victorian period. And actually loads of these crosses are built across the country. And if you look at the Martyrs Memorial, for example, in Oxford, that's inspired by the crosses themselves. And when they are building the Albert Memorial outside Royal Albert Hall, they write about how much they're inspired by the Eleanor crosses, even though it's a different design. Anyway,
It's very easy to miss. It's right outside Charing Cross Station. It's kind of surrounded by fences and barbed wire and stuff. Most people just walk past it, don't even notice it's there. It's not, it has to be said, the most impressive monument in London. So now I'm going to go for a more modern date for my first suggestion, which is 1953. That's not when I was born, because I noticed that a lot of these dates that people have put on here that was passed around, they've said, it's my birthday. But 1953 had everything. This was the year of the Christie murders, 10 Rillington Place. Winston Churchill, it's always good to throw in Winston Churchill at this history festival. He was both knighted and won a Nobel Prize for Literature. The Quatermass experiment was on TV. And Jerusalem was first played at the last night of the proms. Myxomatosis was deliberately introduced into England. The first British nuclear bomb was finished and delivered, not delivered from the sky, but to wherever we keep our nuclear bombs. And yes, the first Italian espresso bar opened in London. And look where that has led. But the two most important things for me are it was the publication of Casino Royale, the very first James Bond book. And with my other hat on, I do a lot in the world of James Bond. But it was also, of course, the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. And I've always found it really fascinating that the connection between Elizabeth and Bond, that they both sort of came into their own in 1953. And then there were so many connections right through their reigns, including Bond, of course, the book on Her Majesty's Secret Service. The MI6, they work for the monarchy. That is their ultimate boss. And the royals would famously be at the James Bond premieres. And the two of them, Bond and Elizabeth, became very much the sort of embodiment of Great Britain, of how we sort of presented ourselves to the world, this man and this woman. Bond is sort of archetypal British agent. The famous moment in The Spy Who Loved Me, where Roger Moore skis off a cliff. You think, oh no, James Bond's going to die. Yeah, we will come on to Daniel Craig in a minute. but then his parachute opens up and it's a Union Jack and everyone jumps up and cheers. But of course, even then people knew it was tongue in cheek. Britain wasn't the empire that it had been. And, you know, the Queen Elizabeth's reign saw pretty much the sort of final dismantling of the British Empire. But Bond represents this sort of nostalgic idea that Britain is still an important force in the world. And it's slightly tongue-in-cheek. And again, you know, Elizabeth became the sort of the face of the country. We sent her all around the world to do a lot of boring diplomatic stuff. But she was probably the most famous person in the world, the most photographed person in the world. And she did represent, as I say, they both represent an idea of Britishness, of Englishness. And of course, at the 2012 Olympics, they met. He turned up at the palace. Originally, she was going to just, you know, they thought, well, we can't tell her to do any acting. But when they turned up, she said, well, I do want to say something. So she, you know, it becomes a great little scene. And then the two of them parachute together into the Olympic Stadium. And that was the ultimate moment of representing us to the world, us who are holding the Olympics. And yes, the Queen Elizabeth died. It wasn't exactly the same year, but it was pretty much almost the same time as Daniel Craig died as James Bond in his final film. So I've always found that a really interesting part of history, and maybe one day I'll write a book about it.
He's been replaced by Paddington, though, hasn't he?
Yes, and what does that say about the decline of Britain? But did you have any... You had some actors in your 18 book, didn't you? You didn't have any Bond actors.
I wrote about, so in my book 18, which is all about people when they're 18 years old in history, one of the people I wrote about was Richard Burton, who went on to become this amazing actor.
I think he was considered as a possible Bond.
Wow.
Yeah, well, he'd be a good one.
But sure. I think they thought he wouldn't do what he was told.
Yeah, I think so. He would turn up on time, yeah.
Well, my last book about the Battle of Arnhem, of course, famously A Bridge Too Far, is the movie that lots of people come to the battle through. And Roy Urquhart, the ill-fated general who commanded 1st Airborne Division, was played by Sean Connery. So, you know, when you frame it like this, John, it's very interesting how, you know, he's in that film because he's seen as a serious action man. And what's quite interesting is he then has it's a flawed role he plays. You know, Urquhart messes the entire thing up. Although... there's a moment where he shoots a German soldier dead with a pistol and suddenly he's 007. takes the guy down. But what's really interesting about that is when they were making the film, Richard Attenborough made A Bridge Too Far. When they were making the film, he got all the main players who were still alive to come and advise on the movie. So you have this extraordinary thing where Lieutenant Colonel John Frost, who fought at the bridge, is Anthony Hopkins, who's playing in there, filming a scene, and Hopkins is running from one building to the other. And Frost says, "Oh no, old boy, you don't run. You mustn't show the men that you're concerned about your personal safety. You must walk." And Hopkins runs in the film because he just didn't believe him. He couldn't do it, you know, with all the squibs going off. But the fantastic thing about it is when Connery was cast, Roy Urquhart is told, you know, and Sean Connery's playing you. He had no idea who he was. He'd never heard of James Bond. And this is 1976, 77. Never heard of him, didn't know who he was. And his daughters, because he was asked if he wanted to come and meet the fellow playing him, come to Holland where they were filming it in Deventer and meet him. And he said, "No, I don't think I can really be bothered with that." And his daughters had to force him to go because they wanted to meet James Bond.
So, and you wanted to have the Battle of Arnhem... as one of, as
well, 1944.
1944 in general.
Yeah, in general. Because I mean, with James, we've talked about 1944 an awful lot. Because all these amazing events as the war sort of reaches its critical mass point from an Allied perspective. But the thing I really love about looking at the history of giant events is they're like pointillist pictures, right? Made of dots, and you zoom out and you see the picture, and then you can go right in and look at the dots, and so. I would say the 17th of July 1944 is a date that I would focus on because it's an incident in Montgomery's headquarters in Normandy, his tactical headquarters in Bray, where an officer called the Colonel Honourable Leo Russell is sent to look at the headquarters and find out what's going on, find out what Monty's up to. And as he arrives, a bloodied pig runs through the headquarters with someone running after it, right? And he's very straight-laced, and he's not ever been in the field. He's a staff officer, and he says, "What on earth's this? You know, I've been assured there's no looting." And at dinner, they're having pork, and someone says, "You know, you enjoying the chops?" And he's mortally offended by it. And so he starts to investigate the looting, and he finds a piano that someone's liberated. He finds a hen coop around the back of the mess. He finds chickens and ducks, and he writes a report, and he goes and sees Montgomery, who basically says, "Like, what? Don't be ridiculous, right? I mean, we're in the field, we're an army. It's not looting, you know." And then the French farmer turns up and demands a compensation for the pig. And one of the captains in the TAC HQ offers him £2, which is a 2-week salary for a captain in the army at the time. French farmer refuses. So this thing starts to boil over. And Colonel Russell goes to see Monty's sort of number two, a guy called Freddy de Gangon. He's this incredible, incredibly diplomatic character who deals with Montgomery. And in the end, he gives him a complete nervous breakdown. And he has to, he's ill a lot because he can't cope with the pressure of dealing with his boss. And Colonel Russell goes to see de Gangon, who in his memoir says, at first I thought this was a you know, I was being put up, you know, it was a joke. But then I realised that the fool, and he calls him Jones in his memoir, he doesn't name him. He says, I thought Jones was being quite ridiculous. And he says to Russell, he says, if I see a duck and I want a duck, then I shall take the duck. Maybe I shall offer to pay the farmer for the duck. But if he refuses the money, I shall take the duck anyway. And Russell writes a report to for the chief of the Imperial General Staff, for Alan Brooke, wanting to charge Montgomery for running a headquarters that's looting and a court-martial charge. And the deputy, Seggs, puts it to one side. It goes into a super top secret file that isn't seen until the 90s. And the thing is, July the 17th is when Montgomery's headquarters are putting together the biggest armoured offensive of the war, Operation Goodwood. Those of you who know about the Second World War will know about Goodwood. This enormous attempt to break out of the Normandy bridgehead. While this bloke's going around on a point of principle, we do not take pigs. And it's the most amazing. And you know, people like to think of war as wars of machines or industries or whatever, but its personality is right in the center of the thing and is so contingent, because it could have been that someone else within Allied headquarters, who's an enemy of Montgomery's, could have got hold of this thing and could have demanded that he be sacked. And then you derail the entire Normandy offensive over a pig. But I think it's just the, you know, the minute and the enormous, you know, happening at the same time, which is the thing I find so fascinating about 1944.
Well, I mean, it had always been point of principle tactic, however you want to describe it, of the British Army. I mean, particularly in the Napoleonic Wars, that Wellington's thing was, we don't loot from the locals. Yeah. We are trying to liberate them.
Yeah.
We don't steal from them. Whereas the French army would just loot everything and maraud about the place. And it's that sort of British discipline and sense of fair play.
But in the 14th century, it was a perk of war. So men went to war because they were told, well, you can loot. That's how they made money. Yeah. It was like, you get some wages, which are going to be paid very late / not at all, but you can steal from the French. And so they were like, all right. And they went to war.
Sounds reasonable.
If the French have ducks, we will take the French ducks. Now, Helen, we're running out of time here, sadly. But can we just talk about one of your other dates that you were suggesting? And I think it's a really fascinating one, is the sumptuary laws.
Mm, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So sumptuary laws were, there wasn't just one sumptuary law. There was a period between around 1300 to 1600 where sumptuary laws were put in place multiple times. And it was effectively a way of controlling what people consumed or wore, as a way of saying, well, you can't look as rich as me. And it was the main one in the 14th century is put in 1363 by Edward III. And what it is it's sort of a way about talking about what happened after the Black Death, because after the Black Death, 50% of the population, around about, if not more, were killed by plague. And it was a period of time where people were no longer bound by this fatalistic sense of their existence. So if they were born a serf, they weren't necessarily going to die a serf working the fields. They could move into apprenticeships because there was a real dearth of people able to do certain craft or trade. So people were able to better themselves. And it was a time really of this growing middle class. And the merchant class became much larger. They became more influential, and they were making a lot more money through import and export of luxury goods. And what I find fascinating about this time as well is people were so excited by the fact that they could better themselves. They were starting to want to dress like the elite. And so the space between this very, very traditional feudal hierarchy was starting to sort of thin. And the elites didn't like this very much. They didn't like the fact that even if people didn't have the same amount of wealth as they did, they could actually, fakes were being made. I find it amazing that, like, we'd have 5 fake handbags today. People were making fake expensive jewels and fake pearls and using tin to create the look of gold. In the same way as people have done ever since. But one way of regulating this and trying to maintain this traditional social hierarchy was putting in law that people weren't allowed to dress in certain ways or in certain materials. So silk was reserved for the elite. Ermine, Miniver. And one interesting fact about Miniver, and people might not know what Miniver is, it's actually squirrel. So it's these sort of very, very soft squirrel skins. And I was doing the maths, and anyone who knows me, this doesn't mean that this was very accurate because my maths is appalling. But thousands and thousands of squirrels were killed for the amount of Miniver that was worn by the wealthy. Something like within the region of maybe hundreds of thousands of squirrels. Yeah. It was like a mass squirrel culling.
These are the old red squirrels.
Yeah, there was all the red squirrels. And it was this mass squirrel culling in the 14th century to line all of the cloaks of the elite. An extraordinary amount of squirrel killing. Anyway, ermine, Miniver, and fine jewels, pearls, all of these things were not allowed to be worn if you were of a certain demographic. Hence the reason why people started to make fakes. And this is what resulted in things like it was a contributing factor to things later on, like the Peasants' Revolt in 1381, this squashing of the middle classes. People started to get a bit frustrated and rebel against it. But it was a law that was essentially put in place in order to restrict people's social mobility.
And am I right in believing, or am I confusing it with something else? There were laws put into effect of quite how long your pointy
That's
shoes
That's what I wanted to know.
Do.
The pointy shoes.
The pointy shoes thing, yeah. This is true. So the longer your shoes were, the more wealthier you were. So you see a lot of images. So if you see images in manuscripts of people working in the fields, and the length of their shoes are much shorter than, say, depictions of the king in the court and his courtiers wearing shoes that were particularly long. Long shoes and short skirts, that was the vibe of Edward III in the 14th century. Yeah.
Little tights.
And tights. Yeah. And men in tights.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's quite interesting because, you know, there are occasionally, it still happens today, where the government thinks they need to make rules about what people can and cannot wear.
Yeah, and it wasn't just wearing, they weren't allowed to have feasts, they weren't allowed to demonstrate any display of opulence. And it was described as being almost grotesque in the amount of opulence that was being demonstrated by this merchant class. And something had to be done about it.
Al, are there any sumptuary laws you'd like to introduce banning people wearing certain things?
Red cords. I've been here 2 days.
Well, I think it would be good to be able to go over to questions. I'm sorry, we've had some great dates that we haven't been able to get round to. Alice, you wanted to talk about 1926. What was the importance of that?
Yes, a very, very, very important year. And well, we were asked to say, can we have a personal selection? This is very personal to me. It's something that's been had a big impact on my life, which is the Dairy Milk Fruit and Nut Bar, which was introduced, I think, in that year. So, but actually, I was thinking about it, and then, you know, thinking about all of the people since that moment who have enjoyed and had a little bit of joy from those chocolate bars, and actually probably has had quite a big impact.
Well, let's go over to the audience now. The volunteers are going to select you and then wave orange things at me.
Are these the ones that people have put forward?
Lucky. Oh, I'll go through that in a minute. Oh, yeah. Now, I've only seemed to have got one of these sheets back. Is there still one circulating that people are writing dates on? If you could bring it up here, that would be great. Right, yes, your question, sir.
Gosh. I mean, I picked up a bunch of stuff from all of your talks. One interesting thing is when, I think you mentioned 1953, when the first espresso bar opened. When the Romans left Britain, I wonder when olive oil actually came back to Britain, because it was, I guess, in modern times, the Italians who had brought it back. I think only in pharmacies they sold olive oil to treat ear ailments. But this is the thing, my internet doesn't work. So I was trying to think when the Anglo-Saxons first invaded entered Britain, because before they entered, the concept of an Englishman didn't exist in Britain, and we wouldn't call, you know, the Britons to include, you know, the identity of England. So I wonder when the identity of the English first emerged, because I actually don't know. I think with the French in 1789, French Revolution, less than, was it like a fifth of the people of France spoke French. So when did that emerge? So but
that sounds like about 100 different questions.
I think I can help with it a little bit though. I would argue that identity is always shifting and changing, and there was never really this quintessential England as we would perhaps consider it. So much of Englishness is politics and rhetoric. It's something that's still used as, nationalism, national identity is still used as political rhetoric today. Certainly in the 14th century, Edward III tried to enhance this idea of Englishness and English identity in order to get people to go to France in war so he could be more European. So, it's just true. There's lots of borrowing of myth and legend, and there's lots of cross-border sharing and this creation of different cultures forming, I suppose, an understanding of what we would consider as English now. But it doesn't mean that there was this traditional shape of England as it was from the Anglo-Saxons all the way through. I mean, at one point with the Norman invasion, England was sort of Normandy and England. You had to think of it as a bit of France and England in the same point. We from Henry II onward, we had Aquitaine and Gascony, and that was technically part of England, but in France. So it's a very complicating thing, but I think it's a very shifting thing. The borders were shifting. It's more of a construct rather than a physical reality.
Yeah, and I was the dates that I was going to say was the birth of James Gilray, who is an 19th century caricaturist and printmaker. And he based during the Napoleonic Wars, he creates this barrage of prints, essentially propaganda. And it is in these moments and in these visuals, the most famous one being the plum pudding in danger, where you see William Pitt and Napoleon carving up the world. But it's in these moments, which is not that long ago, that these ideas of being English versus French come about. Is it because, maybe it's the enemy that actually forces the idea of our own identity?
Well, and the French Revolution flushes out the idea of a citizen and his relationship with the state through nation, right? And that that's a modern idea, the nationalist idea that emerges from the French Revolution is a progressive idea in the 19th century. Yeah. Sort of, if you want, a left-wing idea, quite interestingly. But I mean, the foundation of this country, and I'm going to say this, of the polity we live in, is the Second World War. Battle of Britain, Dunkirk, the idea that we stand alone, even though we're an imperial power at the time, but let's not let that get in the way of the way people imagine it. 1939, there's Empire Day still being celebrated in this country. 1945, the two main political parties' manifestos don't mention the empire. The Conservative Party manifesto doesn't mention the empire. The Labour Party manifesto mentions socialism once, but talks about nation over and over and over and over again. So the nation we inhabit is, I think, more recently birthed. But as you say, it's sort of stepping stones. It's a maze how you arrive at these points.
It's more of a political alliance. So, for example, we talked about England, Scotland right at the beginning. It wasn't a case of England versus Scotland in the England-Scotland Wars of Independence. It was political allegiance. So Robert Bruce had land in England. He fought for Edward I at one point. Yeah. It was what political party you're allying yourself with rather than thinking in terms of nationality.
But yeah, I mean, but calling on the idea of nationhood has always been a tactic used to rally the country. Alfred the Great, we are the English, whatever the Saxon version of it was, and we need to fight off the threat from the Vikings, the pagans. And you see that repeated, Henry V, Battle of Agincourt. And he probably did make a big speech similar to the one in Shakespeare, but then that was resurrected in the Second World War by Laurence Olivier for his film about Henry V, where very much the foreigners, we know actually what it's actually the Germans and the huge flights of arrows going over the top is the Air Force.
What you're saying is exactly right. And I think about looking at the record that I've worked with, a lot of this idea around nationhood comes in the form of protectionism. Yeah. So it becomes in the form of protect our borders, protect our beaches. We are the nation who are going to do that. And that tends to come at a time of threat.
Well, if you want to electrify a national sense, I mean, if Putin doesn't want there to be a Ukraine, he's going completely the wrong way about it, right? He's he's made them make up their minds who they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, it's quite straightforward as a attack and reaction. I think.
Let's go to another question over here.
Hi there. Yeah, excellent talk. Like, really great hearing from you guys. This one's for Al though. No, I mean, I've read the book Black Tuesday.
Yes,
and it's a great book.
Yeah, thank you.
My granddad landed in Market Garden. He was with the Border Regiment. So it honestly means a lot to have people Goodness. Still talking about the story and finding new things. As you know, there's so many sliding door moments in Market Garden.
Yeah.
There's so many bits that went wrong, that could have gone right, whatever. But what in your mind is the sliding door moment for that?
Oh, there was a planning meeting the week before where they, what they should have done is not divided their effort and their lift, and just said to themselves, we can only get the two brigades down on the first day, so we'll do that. We won't bother trying to insert another brigade on the second day because we'll be dividing our effort and lacking concentration of force. But the problem with that, of course, in all counterfactuals, you pull one lever and the whole thing changes. So yes, there'd have been probably more people getting to the bridges at Arnhem, but the German reaction would then have been completely focused on that and not how they were all divided up. And the German reaction was they didn't care about their own casualties as long as they stopped it working. And so that's the sliding door. But then when you look at the way they're quantifying risk and their calculus of risk, they would have never come to that conclusion. So that I'm not saying it was doomed or fated, because there are all sorts of moments and very much contingent on personality as well, which is the other really interesting thing, I think, much more than anything else. But yeah, I mean, that would be it for me.
Another question. Are we lined up anywhere for one? And then we'll come there. We'll have to answer these quite briskly, I think. Does it matter if we go over by 5 minutes?
Nah.
No. We've got 2 minutes. Right, quick question. Yes or no?
Okay. Brilliant talk. Three of the dates that you brought up were from the 20th century. So when this talk is redone in Chalk History Festival 21-25, what dates from so far in the 21st century do you think might be brought up?
Well, today, obviously, when this amazing event happened. Gosh, that is a tough one. I mean, it's really interesting because often it's only a lot later that you realise just how important
Brexit.
Something was.
Brexit,
like a climate summit, maybe, G20, yes. Something like that.
Yeah, and Alice, yeah.
Brexit just, seems yeah. the first one that jumps out to me.
Yes, in terms of...
9/11.
Yeah.
It's good answers, though. Well done.
Brexit.
And then quickly over here.
You've chosen some great dates. But for me, I think that 1471 might have been a good one when the printing press was introduced, because that really did change the world.
Yeah. Yes, that is a brilliant date. Yeah. I can't argue with that. Yeah. You know, it is. None of us would be here without.
I'd like to say that all of those dates are very memorable. But personally speaking, 1713, the Treaty of Utrecht between Britain and Spain, which unfortunately Spain does still not understand the words in perpetuity.
Very strong.
Well, I think we probably haven't got time for any more questions. I'll just have a look at some of the dates you put in it. There are a few birthdays. Magna Carta comes up quite a lot. When was that? 1215, very good. Obviously, 1966 is on the list here. We all know what happened then. 1649, the execution of Charles I, that was a pretty monumental event. Spanish Armada, 1588. Suez Crisis,
56.
Someone's put the abolishment of the Corn Laws, which was a fairly momentous thing in terms of economics, but like me, they don't know what the actual date was. Anyone want to? 1846. Let's say it was 1846. there was one on here. What have I done with it? Someone has written. it has asked, you know, come up with some dates. Someone's written, think for yourself, you lazy git. So maybe on that note, I've really enjoyed it today talking to these guys. I mean, obviously, there's so many dates we could have talked about and so much stuff to talk about, but that's what this festival is all about. You know, what are the important bits of history? And thank you so much for your engagement.